This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Playing music was never a question for Stefan Litvin. As a child, he imitated his father playing classics from Beethoven to Chopin on the piano. But how Stefan played music would change throughout his life. Stefan grew up in a community of Jewish refugees in Mexico City. He turned to the piano at a young age to channel his experience as a second-generation Holocaust survivor. As he grew older, his companions, and I should say his compositions, became more experimental. He continued to carry his family's heritage, crafted pieces that combined his skills in classical music with complex political statements. Today, he splits his time between Germany and Chapel Hill. In Germany, he performs regularly with groups like the Berlin Symphony Orchestra. Here in the States, he's a distinguished professor of music at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stefan Litvin joins me on the program today. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Start, will you please, by telling us your parents' story and how they came to leave Germany.
Well, my father was a journalist in Berlin, and he was one of these social democrats who believed Hitler would pass. But obviously he didn't. And in 1936, my father decided to escape and went to Spain, which at the time was still a country where you could migrate to. But then there the Civil War broke out. And so that was his stroke of luck, because he was able to get a visa to Mexico. And then he started fresh as a man of 30 years in Mexico City, not speaking the language, having been a German journalist. My mother was born in Vienna, and she fled Vienna when Hitler annexed Austria in 1938. And she first went to Britain. She had a visa there as an au pair girl, and when her visa expired, she was forced to go back to the continent. So she went to Belgium, which was still free, but then when the Nazis attacked Belgium, she went on to France on the refugee route. And in France, she was then, when France also succumbed to the Nazis, was interned in one of these internment camps in the south of France, a concentration camp called Gurs. By the way, also a camp where Hannah Arendt was. And in fact, my mother was part of a 200 women group with Hannah Arendt to escape the camp.
The banality of evil.
Yeah, yeah. And so she then hid in the Pyrenees for about a year, hidden by the resistance, until she was able to get a Mexican visa in Marseille. And then she left France on the last ship before the Americans entered Normandy.
So your parents met in Mexico City.
They met in Mexico City. Yeah.
Your mother's story is interesting. She was reluctant to tell you much about it growing up.
Oh, yeah. My sister and I, we were raised not knowing that our mother was Jewish. So my father, we knew, of course, he was Jewish. But my mother always said she was in a camp because she was a communist.
Wow.
So we never questioned it, but it was sort of, in hindsight, when I think about it, all of our relatives were Jews. But as a child, of course, I didn't question it. But then there was a striking moment when I think my sister was invited to be at a Seder in New York with our relatives in New York. And she sort of said innocently, "Oh, it's such a nice tradition. Too bad that Stefan and I are not Jews." And then everybody, cracked up and thought, "What is this?" So it's not an unusual thing that I've learned. Holocaust survivors often try to repress their experiences by assuming a new identity. And my mother assumed this non-Jewish identity in Mexico City, which, of course, was a very Catholic environment.
Right. Well, what was the environment like in that community for
Well,
you?
The thing is, the environment for me as a child was all the friends of my parents spoke German. I mean, I spoke Spanish with the maids and their children and so forth, but with my parents, I spoke German. And everybody there were these strange Germans or Austrians. And later on, I learned that my childhood doctor, an Austrian doctor who had lived in Vienna, was actually good friends with Arnold Schoenberg, a composer who I would later then become very interested in. He actually tutored Schoenberg's first son, Georg, in mathematics in Vienna.
So there you are, hearing Spanish all around you, except at home and in family gatherings where you speak German, and then you go to an English-speaking school.
That's right. So my parents, basically, because I'm assuming because of the experience as refugees, they felt the best thing they can give their children is a good education and multilingual education, mm-hmm. because you never know where you will end up. And probably because of that, I was able to assume a position here at UNC because I do speak English, because I learned it as a child. Had I learned it as an adult, it would have been much more difficult.
Sure. What about music? When did that enter the picture?
As far back as I can remember. I think my father played the piano extremely well, although he was just what you really call an amateur in the best sense. I mean, he loved playing the piano. He could play Mozart, Concerti, and Chopin, Nocturne. And he practiced every day. And I remember that I would try out at the keyboard to play the tunes that he had played, sort of by ear. And all I can remember was that when I had my official piano lesson with a teacher at age 8, I already knew how to play the piano. But I don't remember exactly how I learned it.
Now, you did go through that a rebellious teenage period in which you mm-hmm. thought rock and roll was the thing.
Absolutely.
Right? It is, by the way.
Oh, it is.
Which is not to say Beethoven and Schoenberg and the rest aren't all terrific.
That's right.
But were you thinking of music as a career at that point? When did it start?
Well, my father was the first to push me to practice every day, even when I wanted to play soccer or something else. So it was often under pressure of my father that I would practice the piano when I was a child. But then as a teenager, as you mentioned, when I got interested in rock and roll, and my particular angle was Emerson, Lake and Palmer, uh-huh. which I liked very much. I would spend hours trying to learn from the records to play these pieces I like to listen to so much. So I actually practiced a lot more playing rock and roll than I ever practiced. And I mean, you can't call Emerson, Lake and Palmer rock and roll.
Well, no, I think that there's
rock.
A real and there's an orchestral quality to the music. So
yeah,
it's a little more complicated.
Yeah, and they based a lot of their music on classical models, so forth. And so I think between 14 and 16, I really developed my ear and my technique, and that sort of brought me back to classical music. So it was thanks to Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Well, eventually, your whole family traveled back and forth between Mexico and Switzerland, did they?
Yeah, that had to do with the experience in the war. My parents, as I said, spoke German with each other and with us, and they wanted to live in a German-speaking country. But, of course, Germany or Austria didn't fit anymore after the war. And Switzerland was the only other option, and Switzerland had, to this day, still has a rather limiting policy towards foreigners. And that was exactly the case for my parents. My parents were Mexican citizens now, and we all were Mexican citizens, and we could only live in Switzerland as tourists. So my father managed to allow us to live in Switzerland 6 months out of the year and 6 months in Mexico, when we'd always have to leave Switzerland and return to our home country. So I went to school in both.
Were you studying music?
Yeah, I studied music in both. I mean, studying piano, not music. College music was later.
Did you imagine a career for yourself in music?
Well, I think by the time I was 14, 15 playing, I had my own rock band and so forth. I thought, this is fun. It's a lot easier than going to school. So I thought, yeah, I could imagine myself being a musician. I didn't know what I would be doing as a musician. And then when I met my first real piano teacher at 16, who then would take me through the first years of my college days, I realized that's a model of what one can be a musician like, in not being necessarily a star, but you can make a good living as a musician. So that's when I decided, I think 16, 17.
What about politics? When did you become sensitive to politics or aware of politics?
Well, I was always aware of the experiences my mother had in the camp. Although she didn't speak much about detail, and I certainly knew about politics in the Weimar Republic because of what my father would tell. And my father was a real Berliner. I mean, he loved Berlin. He said that was the best time of his life in the 20s in Berlin. So politics was always sort of a part of our narrative. But I think when I first became really conscious of politics at the moment was when Salvador Allende was toppled. And then 2.5 years later, Argentina, the dictatorship, overthrew the government. And there were soldiers on the streets, these images of torture, of young people, students being arrested. That frightened me. And I thought to myself, wait a second, my parents always talked about military might in Nazi Germany, and now this is happening near us in Mexico. I didn't understand it, but it certainly politicized me. And from there on, I think it was just natural that I would just continue learning about political systems, about political connotations in music as well.
Yeah, I think there's and certainly you can imagine the feeling after World War II. It can never happen again. We figured that out. It will never happen again. I don't know in communities like in Jewish communities. I suspect there might have been a divide, people who are afraid that it's going to happen any moment, and mm-hmm. others who really lived in the hope that we'd put this past us. Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time when this was happening in Latin America, it was being done with the support of the United States. And the United States was the model for my parents. The United States helped parts of my family survive. They were refugees who came, like my parents, to Mexico. They came to the United States, and I still have cousins here all over this country. And so America was a positive force, and it was very difficult for anyone to comprehend that now America was embracing military dictatorship as a means of preventing this hemisphere of becoming communist. That was the argument always, yeah. But I think my parents were politically savvy, and they understood, of course, that Allende was not a communist. He was not even a socialist. By today's terms, you wouldn't say he was a social democrat.
Yeah. He was a social democrat with a very successful experiment in social democracy, which was the most frightening thing to Americans.
And there, I think, my father sort of got back to his roots of social democracy in the Weimar Republic, and he saw what was happening rather critically. And I learned from that.
Tell us about this. You have written a piece called El Once mm-hmm. that talks about that coup. Maybe you can set it up for us. Tell us when you began sort of imagining this piece and what the genesis was.
Well, obviously, in 2013, it was the 40th anniversary of the coup against Allende, which happened on September 11th, 1973. And ever since September 11th, 2001, I've been sort of toying with the idea of doing something that deals with this date that by coincidence happens to be the same day, a Tuesday, September 11th. So there is a piano piece that is very well known by a composer whom I also am friends with, Frederick Jevsky's The People United Will Never Be Defeated, which is based on a Chilean resistance song, which was written only 2 weeks before the coup. Now, that piece I've performed for many years, and I recorded it for CD 2 years ago, and on that CD I also included a composition that's based on Allende's farewell speech to the Chilean people. And at that moment I realized we need to add another piece, and I knew this poem by Gonzalo Millán, a Chilean exile poet, with the name El Once, the 11th. And this poem is an extraordinary poem because it tells the events of September 11th in Chile, but it tells them backwards. So it starts, I can read it. It's not that long. I can read it for you. It says, the river inverts the path of its current. The water of the Cascades rises. The people begin to retreat. The horses walk backwards. The military undo the parades. The bullets come out of the flesh. The bullets enter into the cannons. The officers put their guns into their holsters. The current penetrates the electric outlets. The tortured stop shaking. The tortured close their mouths. the concentration camps empty. The disappeared appear, the dead come out of their graves. The airplanes fly backwards, the rockets rise to the airplanes. Allende shoots. The flames go out. He pulls out the helmet. The moneda rebuilds itself completely. His skull puts itself together. September 11. Chile is a democratic country. The military return to their bases. Neruda is reborn. Víctor Jara plays the guitar, sings, "Venceremos." So this is a very powerful defamiliarization effect. I mean, to use a Brechtian term, sort of to change the events by recounting them, like in a film going backwards. And I thought to myself, what a great text to set to music. And what I did is I set it for, it's kind of an improvisational model for any number of instruments with speaking pianist. And at the very end, and I think we might listen to that segment, you actually hear the song Venceremos, We Shall Overcome, but you hear it backwards.
Let's hear a little bit of that right now.
Se saca el casco, la moneda se reconstituye íntegra. Su cráneo se recompone, sale a un balcón, Allende retrocede hasta Tomás Moro. Los detenidos salen de espalda de los estadios. Once de septiembre. Chile es un país democrático. Las Fuerzas Armadas respetan la Constitución. Los militares vuelven a sus carteles. Renace Neruda. Víctor Jara toca la guitarra. Desfilan cantando, venceremos.
That's a clip of El Once, composed by pianist Stefan Litvin, a concert pianist and composer and a music professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and my guest today on The State of Things. We'll take a break right now, and we'll come back, talk more about that and your life and career on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, pianist and composer Stefan Litvin, is a music professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, among other things. We played just before the break a little piece of your composition, El Once, which commemorates September 11th, 1973, when the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was overthrown with the help and assistance of the United States of America. You wrote the piece in 2013. You said you were affected by it when it happened in 73. Is a piece like that percolating within you all that time, or is there something that sort of jars you back to reconsider?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a musician, as a composer, you run around with lots of ideas of all the things you want to do, and then you realize you only have time to do just certain things. And often, sometimes a historic moment arises that gives you the opportunity of actually realizing something you had already forgotten about. I had that poem tucked away in my notes, and somehow at that moment, 40 years after the coup, I thought, oh, I remember that poem. And so I brought it out and wrote the piece actually very quickly because it had to be done.
Yep.
That's why it's an improvisational model. It's not a, you know, through composed piece.
While you were in Mexico, you were a Mexican citizen, as you said, and that meant that you had compulsory military service.
At the time. I think that it's changed now. But yeah, I was living in Switzerland. When I turned 14, my parents received a permanent residency in Switzerland. So I was able to stay there and I enrolled in Swiss schools. No longer English schools. And then when I turned 18, I was called to do my military service. Otherwise, I would have lost my Mexican citizenship. So that was a little strange, going back to Mexico.
Why was it important to you to keep your Mexican citizenship?
Well, I had no other
citizenship. Oh, you weren't citizens then. You were residents.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Yes,
so I had no other citizenship. I had to go back.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know if you know about the militia system in Mexico. Everybody has to do a military service who turns 18, but it's a lottery system. At least this was at the time. This is a long time ago now. And if you're lucky, your lottery number is not the one picked.
Mm-hmm.
But I was unlucky, and I actually had to show up at the exercise field. And what you do, they have military professional military in Mexico, which is hardcore. But this is people like me, you know, are asked to come to march on the fields every Sunday for a whole year, or you can divide it over 2 years. So 52 Sundays you have to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. That's your military service. You live at home. So I was studying piano and so forth, but it was such a kind of ridiculous thing. You would come in the morning. You'd be crawling through the mud and so forth. And at some point, the sergeant just says, okay, enough of this. Let's play soccer.
Okay.
So I thought after this, I had just begun studying music in Switzerland. And the piano teacher I had in Mexico, though good, was not the person I wanted to be studying with. And I thought to myself, this cannot be. I can't do this for a year. So I finagled a way to get out of the country. My passport was not valid at the time because I didn't have the stamp of the military. And so I went back to Switzerland to study. And then I actually lost my Mexican passport because I couldn't be renewed. So I was stateless for a few years.
How'd you get it back?
Well, the law changed. And then it was fine. So I was no longer illegal.
Tell us how you got connected with the LaSalle Quartet. That's
well,
a very important one.
LaSalle Quartet was an important connection for me because they, when I studied my undergraduate degree in Basel, Switzerland, they were giving yearly chamber music courses there. And I enrolled in the course just to play a Beethoven trio with them and work with them. And was just a kind of running into my own family. That's how it felt. Because
coincidentally, it seemed that there was a great number of were Jewish refugees in that?
Well, the LaSalle Quartet itself was a quartet made up of German Jews.
And is that intentional? That part was intentional?
I think at the time it was a coincidence. I mean, Walter Levine was a Berlin Jew like my father, who had first emigrated to Israel, to Palestine. The second violinist, Henry Meyer, actually survived Auschwitz playing in the orchestra. And he was from Dresden. And Peter Chemnitzer, the violist, was also a German Jew. And they all met at Juilliard in the late 1940s, and formed a quartet as sort of the first quartet to study with a Juilliard string quartet. And they became one of the most prolific quartets of their generation. And what interested me so much, they also had a huge fervor for contemporary music. They commissioned works by Luigi Nono, by Lutoslawski, by Ligeti, by all the great names, and performed these pieces, whereas most other famous quartets often steer towards the traditional repertoire. And I guess because of this nature of the Jewish refugee status, even for them, they had all then come to the United States, and they were at this time living in Cincinnati as quartet in residence. Walter Levine liked me and said, you know, why don't you come in and study with me in Cincinnati, interpretation. He had taught James Levine in Cincinnati, and I thought, well, you know, if I'm only half that successful, why not?
So, but you said it felt like home to you in
yeah,
a lot of ways.
I came to Cincinnati, and, you know, in my Swiss days, I had no contact to any Jews. You know, I had a lot of contact to leftist people. Even that might surprise you, Switzerland having leftist people, but there were some.
I thought they were always in the middle.
Yeah.
Forgive me. Right.
And so when I arrived in Cincinnati, yeah, it was sort of a deja vu experience. Suddenly, this group of Jewish refugees who had made it to the United States, among them, the group around the LaSalle Quartet had a woman by the name of Annie Donat, who was the niece of Arthur Schnitzler. The great Viennese writer who played cards with Freud. So it wasn't America. It was again kind of a refugee environment, emigrant environment. I shouldn't call it refugee.
It's interesting. I mean, you're really always in many ways the outsider, right?
Yeah.
And are you feeling? I mean, did you feel like that wherever you went, where you studied, where you went to school? Are you feeling?
I suppose. I was never part of the mainstream, and I still am not. I was always astutely aware that the majority was elsewhere than where I was at the time. In Mexico, speaking German at home. In Switzerland, not speaking Swiss German, but High German. In America, not being an American, but being... Now I'm actually a German citizen, so I'm always not what the majority is.
Well, tell us about that, about getting to Germany and becoming a German citizen.
Well, this was actually during the Cincinnati time. I came to the United States on a student visa, but as a Mexican. And I had not been back to Mexico since that military service, so this was quite a while. And I was beginning to get concerned that if I was ever forced to live in the country where I was born, it could only be Mexico, and I had no contact. Certainly artistically or culturally, I had no relationship to Mexico anymore. So I applied for repatriation. My father had been denationalized by the Nazis. And I was able to, because of that, I could prove that I was able to apply for a German citizenship. And I received it in a matter of 1 year. And that's how I got a German passport, never having lived in Germany before.
When you got there, is it true that you felt at home there? There was something about
in
Germany?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. At first, I mean, I was hired at the Hochschule für Musik Saar in Saarbrücken, which is on the border to France, where I still teach. And I didn't feel at home because this was my first experience being in Germany.
Yeah.
The first time I felt at home in Germany was when I moved to Berlin. I was invited to be a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin at the so-called Wissenschaftskolleg. And there I was able to sort of pick up where my father had left off. Berlin was his town. Now I was back there. And now I'm married there, living happily as a Berliner.
So this is artistically a kind of trajectory and a journey for you. Politically, you know, it's one thing to sort of do an overt work where you try to remember an event like the Chilean overthrow. But you say that there's a lot of politics embedded in music and even in the way we interpret Beethoven, for
instance.
Well, tell us more about that.
Well, you see, music is an art form that has many layers, and the one layer that everybody's focused on is the surface, which is apparently, you know, just pitches, rhythm, dynamics, and tone color, sort of the so-called parameters. But that these parameters are put together by people who live in a certain historical context is often forgotten. And Beethoven, when he, for instance, composed, he was in the middle of a historical upheaval, the French Revolution, and not far from where he was living in Bonn, were the coalitionary wars against revolutionary France. So he was picking up on the spirit of the time, to use that that term, and with an extraordinary ability to capture certain motifs of the period, he wrote music that would reflect the times. Now, today, Beethoven is a commodity. Mm-hmm. We listen to Beethoven, oh yeah, that's a classical composer. And you can listen to his piano concerti, his symphonies that way, but if you choose to delve into the depths of it, to all the different connotations that are embedded in this music, you'll be surprised what you can find. And sometimes more than in literature of the time, because literature was censored. Right. Nobody believes that music has any political message, so there's no need to censor it as a composer. So,
but interpretations, too, are very important. And you talked about the way Beethoven has been interpreted over time, particularly in Germany, that are sort of very deliberate.
I mean, the point was there was no composer under Nazi rule, for instance, who represented more of what Germany was supposed to be. But it was based on a wrong understanding of Beethoven's style. Wagner had introduced the idea that true German tempi are slow tempi and fast tempi are Jewish tempi, Mendelssohn. So that permeated through the generations, and you had conductors like Wilhelm Furtwängler conducting Beethoven very slowly, and on the other side, Arturo Toscanini conducting it appropriately in faster tempi. And performance practice itself is a way of promoting certain views of historical music, and with all the repressive elements that go with that. So sometimes, if you follow the conventions of Beethoven performance, you will also be aware that certain things are not being played as they're written, and you wonder why. Why do these famous musicians not play what's written in the score? This is a question I ask myself daily.
I'm talking today with music professor Stefan Litvin on the state of things. We have an example of that. You talked about the ways in which, I mean, it's very clear. There are metronome markings on the page. Mm-hmm. Here's how fast to play it. And you're saying just ignore it because, I guess because of the influence of Wagner.
And because of the influence of today's performance conventions.
Well, let's listen to, we've set up go ahead.
Let me just point out something. This, what we're going to hear, the excerpt, is actually a waltz from from Beethoven's first piano concerto, the second movement. Now, I think, as far as I know, I'm the only pianist who actually plays it as a waltz. And that is one of the reasons why I chose this example. The conventions have this play as a solemn, slow piece of music, but they never would think it could be a waltz. Why? Because a waltz doesn't seem to fit Beethoven. And maybe we can talk about that afterwards.
Let's play a little clip. This would be a more conventional rendering of this particular piece, Friedrich Gulda performing part of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1. There's Friedrich Gulda performing part of Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 1. Here's what Stefan Litvin has to say. I think even an untrained ear could hear the difference between those two.
But you see, it's all in the score. It's all written. Right. If you just do what's written, a waltz comes out. And that just shows you the power of convention, the negative power of convention, because nobody does it. Musicians sometimes read the score and say, well, it may be written, but nobody's doing it, so why should I do it? And the political connotation is, of course, interesting, or the social connotation. The waltz at the time was considered an obscene dance. You weren't allowed to dance a waltz in certain cities. It was forbidden because you were allowed to embrace. So it was kind of a pornographic music.
What do you think about the role of art in politics today? I really only have about a minute left for this answer, and I'm sorry, but the fact that it is seen as not terribly political often, unless it's overtly political, does it have an influence if it's that subtle? If I don't
does
know.
Does music have
does
an
music,
influence?
Does music, in particular music,
I think very little. I think very little, unfortunately. In certain agitprop phases it does. And rap music has had some influence, also in the Arab world and so forth. So the classical contemporary scene with political music has, of course, no influence. But it is a means of reflecting on what happens. And I think that is not a small feat itself.
Great pleasure to talk with you. My guest, composer and pianist Stefan Litvin, music professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for talking.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley's our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Brett Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.